Walt Mossberg reminds us that it's not our fault. A new benefits bill for the gig economy, smart pants and our dystopian future. And Spencer Soper from Amazon is here to answer all of our online grocery store questions. All that and a whole lot more coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1776, recorded Thursday, May 25th, 2017.
Welcome to our Tech News Lair. Where we tell you everything you need to know about technology, nothing you don't need to know. I am Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. Two things to know. Number one, today is Towel Day. So there you go. Number two, 40 years ago today, Star Wars debuted in movie theaters.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?
I only knew that
because of Twitter.
I knew that. I'd heard. We discussed that in our production meeting earlier this week.
Well, yeah, but then I forgot.
I know, because we talked about the costumes and how I have
there were a lot
of
other
them.
Things in that production.
Yeah, that's true. But I looked when I was composing my costume du jour, I looked at all of my Princess Leia and Rey costumes, and none of them were speaking to me today.
It just wasn't the right day for that. I looked at my Rey and Princess Leia costumes as well, and just wasn't my day for that either. So I understand.
Yeah. I'm really working on the Hoth Leia. That's why nothing was speaking to me. That's all my goal. And I just don't know how I'm going to do the hair yet. If anyone can help me with that, Megan at twit.tv.
When do we see, when does that happen?
Probably Halloween.
Okay.
Oh, you mean in the movies or?
No. Okay. No, I mean, when you get to the point where you're like, I think I've got this, I'm going to wear it now. It would be Halloween, or it wouldn't just be a random day out of nowhere.
Also, it has to be cold.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
Journalist Walt Mossberg has posted his last column on Recode, the site he co-founded. So now you're just left with us and our Star Wars commentary. He says it's his final weekly column that he plans to write anywhere. Mossberg had already announced his retirement, but reading his last words on tech was strangely sad, but also optimistic for me. I've been following Mossberg for forever at the Wall Street Journal, All Things D, and Recode. His final piece is worth your time. It describes our ambient computing future, where devices that we interact with on our desks, in our laps, or on our hands are no more, and computing is simply around us, in the air. And as a gadget lover, Mossberg writes, this makes him sad, but as a tech believer, he says, it's exciting.
Yeah, it's a good kind of farewell article for definitely, I think, in the technology world, a living legend. You know, he's defined a lot of how modern technology writers write just based on his perspective. And I think that's always been kind of his strength, right? Like he mentioned in this article, he compares, you know, the current kind of emerging technology that we talk about all the time on this show, AI, autonomous vehicles, all this kind of stuff that feels so omnipresent right now. He compares it to the Commodore PET, which is close to my heart, those old school Commodore computers, and how that related to desktop computing in the sense that, you know, back then that really seemed so cutting edge and so future forward thinking. But now you look back on that and you realize that was just the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, it's become so much more refined over the years. That's where we're at with all of these other things that we're talking so much about now. But we're really, you know, VR is another example of that, that we're really just at the beginning. And that's just kind of an aspect of him that makes his writing so strong, that he pulls from such great perspective, because he's been in this for so long. He's been doing this for so long.
Yeah, I mean, his first column was 1991. That was the year I graduated from high school. And so obviously computers were already around, had been around, but personal computing and gadgets were not as big of a deal. They were hard to use. His line, which is often quoted, was personal computers are just too hard to use and it isn't your fault, which is so much part of what I have always loved about being in technology journalism. Mm-hmm. Just like, don't blame yourself. that person throwing a bunch of acronyms at you are doing it because they're trying to prove something. You're not an idiot. Like that's what I have felt so strongly. And so I don't know what he's going to do next. I mean, he's retiring, obviously, But it's good to read and think about the idea of, yeah, like that, just talking in the air to our devices. That is the future, I think.
Yeah, it is. And we're living in it. I don't know. Do you think this is the last we see him writing? I have a feeling, like, I don't know how you spend all of that time writing and having that outlet for your thoughts, mm-hmm. and then being like, all right, well, I'm done. I'm not going to do that anymore. Yeah. That's not going to be an outlet for me anymore. I have a feeling we'll see him again.
Well, that's what Philip Roth said. And so far he has not written anymore. So if Walt Mossberg is the Philip Roth of technology journalism, then yeah, maybe we won't hear from him again.
Maybe not then. Facebook, Google, and Apple all have their own competing formats for speeding up the work of publishers on mobile devices. Facebook's Instant Articles, for example, is now today opening up to support Google's AMP and Apple's news formats in its open source dev kit. An extension will allow publishers to create their content in a way that supports all three formats. So kind of create it once, it takes markup from Instant Articles, then adds other needed components to support those other platforms. So, yeah, I mean, I guess ultimately this is one of those gambles that all of these, you know, sites and companies kind of took, that publishers were going to be happy taking their content and kind of formatting it in a way that only really works on a per service basis, with the promise of it being, you know, lighter for the mobile user, because we're in a mobile world right now, and that's really important for them. But at the same time, it's kind of a walled garden approach. It requires a lot of work in multiple different places. And I think ultimately they weren't getting as much of a payoff from it as they maybe do by just offering up their stuff through their own site.
Right. They didn't like the deals that they were getting through Facebook. And it's sort of, I mean, this admission, like, okay, it's sort of like, well, Instant Articles didn't succeed. I feel like it was introduced in a different time. You know, it was like 2 years ago, year and a half, I guess 2 years ago. And it was to much fanfare and everybody wanted in. And, you know, here were these places, these vaunted places like the New York Times and National Geographic who got in. But then that was before, now Facebook is the place where people are sharing fake news and, you know, mm-hmm. it's just not trustworthy and we feel uneasy about what we're reading on Facebook. And it's just not the same place where you go for authority. So I think they're sort of, it feels like they're giving up a little bit on it, and they have pushed, they have this big video push as well.
Right.
So it just sort of seems like this is what they're saying is like, hey, now you can, you know, this is great for developers because you can do all this in one, you know, it's open source for you. But what we're really saying is like, you know, this didn't really work for us, so we don't really care about it anymore.
Yeah. And I mean, on one hand, it lowers the effort that's required of the publishers and the people that are working with that content to create them in a way that it works for all of these different platforms. But it doesn't really tackle kind of the bigger issue around incentive for them to do that. There's some built-in incentive, but still they're kind of letting go of their content to a certain degree, allowing themselves to be paid, you know, a certain percentage that is different than what they'd be paid if they were just serving it through their site and being able to get the added benefit of, you know, offering subscriptions that they're exposed to when they're on the site, or ads that they serve up themselves on their own page that they, you know, make money from. So there's a give and take there, and I'm not sure how much this would sway publishers who have already kind of decided like it's not their cup of tea. Forbes, Hearst, New York Times, they all bailed on Instant Articles back in April, not very long ago. And there's a whole lot of others that have, you know, kind of considered it. It was a neat idea. I just, even from the beginning when I saw it, I was like, why would they want to do that? I mean, obviously they're signing up to do it, but what is the greater benefit in the long term? And I think what we're seeing is, you know, they stand to make less. And so why would they?
Right. And they can't. I mean, those publications can't make less. Like they are.
Oh, yeah. Especially right now.
Right now, it is not good for journalists. And they've done everything to figure out ways to monetize. Mm-hmm. And there's no silver bullet. Yesterday, we talked about the advertising that Google can now do, connecting your brick and mortar purchases to what ads you might have seen online and handing that over to the advertisers and saying, you know, here, yeah, we showed you our ad. Mm-hmm. And then this person, we proved they walked into the Target and, you know, bought that brand of cereal. And I listened to this morning, This Week in Google, which, Jeff Jarvis and Leo were talking about this. And they brought up a good point that who should really be scared of this you know, this very targeted advertising is media companies, because they can't do that. Like, you know, journalists can't do that. There's no way, like, they can't catch up with the amount of data that Google has and that Facebook has and that all of them have, that massive, you know, tracking us on our phones, our credit card receipts, all of that. Advertisers can look at them and say, hey, you know, my ad really worked. You know, I you can show me that you showed that to that person, and then they went and bought that.
Yeah.
And journalists really can't do that.
Yeah, publishers can just show you the content and hope that you get exposed to the advertisements that they have embedded in the page, as one example.
Well, this week, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security met with European officials to discuss a potential laptop ban on flights. While no specific timeline has been set, Bloomberg reports that some airports will begin to test begin tests to determine the feasibility of the ban. There's currently a ban on laptops and other large electronic devices on U.S.-bound flights from 10 airports in the Middle East. So that's what we're talking about now, Europe banning and banning large electronics from in U.S.-bound flights. So it they're testing it to see. And yet security experts continue to be baffled by the ban. A lot of people are just, you know, pointing out the fear of having those lithium ion batteries in the belly of the plane, which does not sound safe. Airline stocks are down. People are talking about not flying. Leo said that people, that a lot of business people are trying to book boats to go across, to go to Europe.
Oh.
And, you know, just because they can't use their laptop or because, you know, they're...
And no one wants to be without their laptop for 10 hours.
No. So, yeah, it's... they have not made any decision yet.
Yeah. Is it any less, or is it any more safe to have a laptop up top if it's if there's a lithium ion concern? Like, why is it more... Why is it less safe to have it underneath versus...
Because nobody would know it was on fire for a while. Like, when
but it
you,
would still be a risk. So then, I mean...
Well, you know, when the flights had the batteries that were burning on the phones, not the laptops, then
I see
you
what
knew,
you're
like, oh, okay,
if it's
there's,
down there,
there's
then,
smoking. Maybe just, we shouldn't take off, or maybe we should land the plane, or maybe we should put out the fire.
Yeah, I suppose so. As I guess I also don't know. I don't know firsthand, like, what kind of systems airlines have in place, because I'm sure lithium ion is not the only risk that you take in storing, you know, luggage underneath. So they have to have systems in place that monitor for that sort of stuff and have early detection systems, whatever. But we also know that this isn't just about lithium ion. Like, I mean, it was in the news not too long ago that President Trump had the Russian foreign minister in the White House. And, you know, the Washington Post basically said that, you know, sources had told them about ISIS using laptops as bombs. And so that's, I think, a very big part of why they're pursuing this aggressively at this point, is they're saying any flights coming in to the U.S. from these places that might actually have someone on it that would bring a laptop disguised as a bomb, or a bomb disguised as a laptop on board, let's get that out of their hands. I don't know if moving that underneath the plane solves the issue necessarily, but maybe it does. Maybe from what they know, it has to be more of a manual activation as opposed to being separated from. But yeah, there's definitely that deeper kind of political aspect to it as well. Burke says lithium fires also need special extinguishers too. Because they're not, it's not as easy to put those out with a standard. You can't. Okay. Chemical reaction. Yeah,
yeah. It doesn't need oxygen to burn because all the fuel is provided by the battery. But me and Padre have talked about it, and he said that the fear of having all the batteries stored together is that if one gets set off, it could trigger all of them. So it's like putting them all in the same spot, and then they all go up. Yeah. You know?
So then, at what point do we just not? Or are we not allowed to bring laptops on a plane at all? Because no matter what, it sounds like there's a lot of reasons that they would have to not want them on there to begin with. You know, that's next year. That's 2018, probably. T-Mobile is launching a new program called Digits on May 31st that virtualizes its customer phone numbers in a way that makes them accessible across a number of different platforms and devices. The new system will be free for all T-Mobile users, and for those who might want more than one number to hand out, they can pay an additional $10 to snag an extra number. One single device can access up to five separate numbers under the program. This really reminded me a lot of what I've done with what you can do with Google Voice, where you're kind of you can have multiple phone numbers, and through the Google Voice app, you know, you can have one that's dedicated that you receive calls for personal, one for business, or however you want to set it up. So it seems like T-Mobile's kind of doing this, offering it through their own app on the network side of things.
So is it also what, like, you can do if you have an iPhone and iMessage, like, or messages on your laptop? Like, I get all my text messages on my laptop or my iPad or everywhere.
I mean, that's certainly a part of it, absolutely.
But you can't do that with the idea. Android?
Well, you can with apps and stuff. T-Mobile's just kind of doing it themselves and offering it to all of their users. I could do that with Google Voice, and that's what I do and have done for years. So there are ways around it, but T-Mobile is basically saying every subscriber on their network has access to this now. iOS, obviously, has offered similar functionality through the Apple ecosystem. This is like for everybody that's a T-Mobile user.
Mm-hmm. But not the... not the second phone number necessarily.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it goes a little bit further than what you have on iOS, in the sense that that allows you to kind of like use your laptop, I'm assuming, through iMessage in order to send text messages or whatever. And this is kind of like creating virtual numbers and doing whatever you want with them, be it making calls from whatever device, receiving or sending text messages, notifications about those, all those kinds of things. So it's a little bit more flexible. Kind of a cool option, I suppose. And then in other news, T-Mobile is appealing to switchers from Verizon who own iPhones or Pixel phones, saying as of May 31st, T-Mobile will pay all unpaid balances related to the switch. That phone can then be used on the T-Mobile network because, you know, both of those devices have all the required antennas to do so with their new service, though they will be required to enroll in the $15 per month insurance plan for the device. So
they always get you.
Kind of like taking your payment from over here and moving it over there. But if you want to switch, hey, that's one way to do it. You'd own the device at that point. There's at least that, but you're probably, I'm guessing, signing some sort of a contract for the $15 replacement or insurance plan. Maybe not, though. Actually, I didn't look that up. Because they don't have contracts for service, so maybe you don't. So that sounds like a pretty good deal, actually.
Mm-hmm. There's a few things that drive me as crazy as the cell phone deals and the things that they offer. And they're like, it's free. All you have to do is pay $900 over the next year. You know, and it's just, so I looked at Sprint. I have Sprint, and I feel like I'm an indentured servant to Sprint because I have now five phones, five people in my family, and we're paying them off at $15 a month. And Sprint, they offer a similar plan. They offer another plan. They'll cover the cost. It's slightly different. They require you to purchase a new phone. So whenever I see those plans,
so you can
of
come
like
over,
oh,
you
switch.
Just had to buy a phone on
yeah.
our network.
Like everyone's like, why are you still on Sprint? Because I have five phones and I'd have to buy five more phones.
Now, if they offered this to Sprint, would you consider doing it?
And then have to pay the $15 a month.
I wonder if you'd have to pay that for each of the devices.
That's a good question, because right now we're paying $15 a month basically for all of our devices.
Right.
Maybe a little more too.
But at that point, you'd own the devices. Then I guess it's a matter of how long do you actually have to pay that $15 per month insurance plan. If you pay that 1 month and then you're done, they couldn't possibly make it that easy. But if you do, then hey, that sounds like a pretty good deal. But it doesn't matter because you're on Sprint, you're not on Verizon, and this is for Verizon customers. Mm-hmm. Maybe they'll open it up.
Yeah. Whenever I think about Sprint, I just have to take deep breaths and accept it is what it is. I'd just be Buddhist about my Sprint.
Right.
Subscription, Sprint, indentured servitude. BuzzFeed reports that Virginia Senator Mark Warner just introduced a bill that might solve the problem of benefits for workers in the gig economy, like Uber, Lyft, and all the others. The bill would offer the Labor Department $20 million for pilot programs related to offering benefits that aren't linked to employee status. Warner says he wants to experiment with what works for these new kinds of employees created by the tech industry, with flexible jobs that aren't exactly full-time workers, but who still need benefits. So he's not just talking about health benefits. He's talking about disability benefits, retirement benefits. These are, just maybe a pot that they would all pay into. And if they decided to work for Lyft, or if they decided to work for, the next gig economy that's designed to come over and, iron my clothes or whatever thing we're going to think of next, that we pay a person to do a thing just once and we have no connection to them otherwise. So I applaud this. This is what something that I've wanted for a long time. Like I've always felt
you've talked about
like, there should be some other classification for employees, because I get it. It's great to have a flexible job, to be an on-demand employee, but then what do you do about benefits? And so there should just be a different, just a different classification. I don't know how it works. This sounds good. You know, we'll see. This was just, he just introduced the bill today, so it's got a long way to go.
I support it as well. I think, you know, bringing benefits to as many people, including, you know, and not just limiting it to what type of job, if even if it's a gig economy job, you know, many people have that as their full-time work, and I support it. That's awesome. Awesome that there's the possibility of that. Amazon has big plans to upend the grocery model we've talked about on the show in the past. And joining us to talk about its latest venture is Spencer Soper from Bloomberg Technology. How's it going, Spencer?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you here. So tell us a little bit about this news that that you wrote about today, about how the Amazon Fresh pickup locations are kind of rolling out in Seattle. What's this all about?
Yeah, so they've had two pickup locations. It looks kind of like a gas station convenience store. If you visualize, you know, just like parking spaces with a big canopy above. And exactly. And so basically just a place where you can order your groceries online, pull into one of these parking spaces, and then have them loaded into your trunk. So you're not going into an actual store, but you're just pulling in and getting your groceries placed in your car. It's similar to what stores like Walmart, Kroger are calling click and collect. Same thing. You can pick up your groceries without having to go into the store. And so this is one of Amazon's latest pushes. They've got two of them in Seattle. And it's part of their physical store grocery push, because grocery is a category they've been working on since 2007. Mm-hmm. And it's just been very slow to ship online.
So this is not one of the stores that they're testing with employees where you get to just walk out without paying for anything.
No, that's called Amazon Go. And that one, they unveiled that one first, and that's still in employee only beta testing. They have not opened that one yet. And we've just been told that the technology kind of bugs out when the store gets too crowded. So it's interesting that the drive-in kiosks were introduced after the Amazon Go, but the drive-in kiosks have actually opened to the public before the Amazon Go.
Yeah, I'm guessing with the coordination of the technology and everything, tracking people inside a store versus like taking an order and waiting for someone to pull into a parking spot, maybe a little bit easier with what they rolled out today. About what is the turnaround time? So I'm an Amazon user. I go online. I do my shopping. I say I'm going to go pick it up. Do I just run right over and it's ready for me, or does it take a little bit of time?
They're saying in as little as 15 minutes. So if you're close by, you can order and your order will be ready in as little as 15 minutes, or you can pick a pickup time. So you can select a slot.
So there's so many different aspects of what Amazon's doing in the grocery area. There's what you're talking about, then there's the Amazon Go, and then the Amazon Pantry.
Amazon, that's outside of grocery, but they're doing a lot of brick and mortar. Yeah.
Right. There's the Amazon Prime Pantry, which I now seem to be, when I'm shopping, I've been struggling with that lately, because it's like, 31% of your pantry box is full and then you'll get free shipping. But I've been a Prime member forever and I thought I already got Prime shipping. So I guess what I figured out was Prime Pantry is like if you just want to order like one tube of toothpaste or something, right?
Yeah, you have to think about a few things. One, grocery is very low margin, so they make it up on volume. If you make a trip to your grocery store, or say you go to Target or a Kroger or a Walmart to buy groceries, you're going to have a lot of things in your cart. You rarely go there just to get one thing. And so what they lack in margin, they make up for in volume, and they make up for in impulse buys. So that makes it difficult for e-commerce, especially a company like Amazon has got everybody so conditioned to just get what you need and order it, because you're not necessarily paying extra for the shipping. And so these are kind of an answer to that. Let the customer participate in the last mile of delivery. And it's also just a way for them to get customers used to buying groceries from Amazon, because it's just been a difficult category for them to crack. And like you mentioned, they have a variety of offerings online. I think Amazon Pantry, Subscribe and Save, Dash Buttons. all of these different things, you know, which shows how much energy they're dedicating to cracking the code to get grocery, because it's an $800 billion category. So they see a lot of upside potential if they can figure it out.
Like, we will not repeat the mistakes of WebVan. So what is there any extra fee, or does any Amazon Prime member automatically get the ability to, like, drive up and pick things up, or do they have to pay more for that?
This is open to Prime members. So you have to be a Prime member. You can't. So that those are people who pay $99 a year for delivery discounts and for the movie streaming and music streaming. That's who this is open to. If you're not a Prime member, you can't go to the click and collect. But there is no additional fee, okay, like there was with Amazon Fresh, which I think was about, you know, had been about $300 or something, and they reduced that.
Yeah, yeah, it gets a little confusing to kind of pick through all the different options. Any plans to bring this outside of Seattle? I know that's, you know, where the company is based. I'm sure this is kind of a test market sort of thing. They have plans to expand?
Yeah, this is the Petri dish, and so you can expect to see others around the country if it takes off. It's where they opened their first bookstore. They've now got the bookstores in several cities. So yeah, this is kind of their Petri dish, and then once they learn how to execute it, then they broaden it out from there. And there's going to probably be some overlap, and look where they have Prime concentration. You know, they have a concentration of Prime members. You know, that can support this kind of service.
And what about, like, if you wanted to buy some peaches and that you looked in your bag when they brought it out to you and they were all bruised? Is it the kind of thing where you could say, like, get me another peach? Or is it like you get what's in the bag and you like it or not?
That's a good question. A company like Amazon, I imagine you'll get another bag. And that's likely a big part of this is there are things you're willing to buy online without necessarily seeing them, smelling them, touching them. And there's things that you want to see. And I think that's where online grocery has had a problem, is do you trust someone else to pick out your produce? And here, at least you'd have the comfort of at least seeing it before they put it in your car and perhaps requesting something else. But I haven't actually used it or tried to send back the peaches, so I'm not entirely sure yet. But just Amazon has a very high customer satisfaction ranking, so I imagine they're not going to send customers out of there with stuff they're unhappy with.
Yeah, and I think actually, you know, when that was a big problem with WebVan, which you said failed, and I think that, you know, they've gotten, like, the whole produce industry, I think, has gotten better, you know, maybe through GMO, who knows, but gotten better at fewer bruised peaches, I've noticed, in the store. So we've heard that Whole Foods is not doing well, and you wrote a piece a couple weeks ago about how Amazon was going to buy them, but then they didn't. Can you tell us about what happened there?
Yeah, just so we heard that there was consideration for buying Whole Foods and a question of price and also their own deliberations. So if they are serious about brick and mortar, acquisitions would be a quick way for them to establish a large footprint quickly, as opposed to negotiating deals one at a time. And then the advantage of them going from scratch is they can kind of create the infrastructure themselves, build it precisely how they want it. And so that's where there's some internal discussion within Amazon, how deep to go with brick and mortar and the best possible concept. Because we've heard about a potential third model, the first being the Amazon Go, which is the convenience store concept and no checkout lines. The second one, the one we talked about now, about the drive-in kiosks. And a third would be like a hybrid store, which addresses exactly what you were talking about with the bruised peaches. It would have an area accessible to customers where you could do things like inspect your steaks and inspect your apples before buying them, you know, maybe tap the watermelons. And then the CPG, you know, the consumer packaged goods like box cereal, canned tomatoes, things you don't necessarily need to see, would be on the same site, but not in a customer accessible location, and more typical online fulfillment. And so you would just pick those things up on your way out after you had browsed the things like the lettuce and the meats that you might want to inspect before buying.
So you have on Bloomberg, you have a bunch of different pieces on Amazon. Such a fascinating company. There was, I guess a couple of weeks ago, you interviewed a VP of a marketing technology company who said Amazon wants to be the first thing that every customer thinks about before they buy anything. And it looks like they really are headed that way. I mean, if you had to guess, is there anything that can get in their way of that at this point?
Well, they're up against Walmart. Walmart, about 50% of their revenue is grocery. They're up against consumer habits. They're up against the fact that people like to leave the house. They definitely have the strength of customer trust and customer loyalty. And so they're always going to get an audience with the new things that they introduce. The question is, can they dislodge and prevent customers from going to stores? Because a lot of people still like to go to the store or just go to the store for the reasons we talked about, being able to inspect the things, they're familiar with the products, they even know the store layout. So their shopping might be not such of a hassle for them.
I like that idea. Like maybe what they need to do to disrupt the industry is just make it really unpleasant to go outside.
Influence the weather with their drones or something. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, they've created this whole new market of, like, instead of impulse buys, like, I really needed paper towels the other day and I had not ordered anything from my Amazon Echo yet. And I just said, you know, I told her to order paper towels. And I got this giant box of, and I think it was like $40 or something, and paper towels for the rest of my life. And, you know, it's like that's where they're making the money, right? Like it's very convenient of me just to speak the words and have it arrive. But it certainly wasn't the best, most economical way for me to buy paper towels.
Yeah, you have to break consumers down into categories. There are going to be people with a surplus of time and not a lot of money who are going to look around to save a few cents on individual products. There are going to be people who have more money and not a lot of time. And just that ease of that transaction, they don't care if it's the best price as long as they feel it's a fair price and they can quickly knock some things off their list. You know, Amazon's going to be the solution for them. So for the price conscious shopper, there's still a lot of ways to beat Amazon's prices in grocery.
Absolutely. Spencer Soper with Bloomberg, thank you so much for taking time today to join us to talk about this. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you. You
find him on Bloomberg.com.
And he is awesome.
He is awesome. Mm-hmm. It's true.
Thanks to everyone who sent messages about how to double clutch. I now know it's a verb and I know how to do it. If I ever find myself in a truck, I will know. I also know how to pronounce Huawei. Now we got feedback from Nick. He says the H in Huawei, Chinese hardware manufacturer, should actually be pronounced. I've noticed that you regularly say it like Huawei. Just add a little push of air in front of it to make that H sound. Huawei.
It's true. Like I did not even pay attention to this fact. And when I read this email earlier today, I was like, dang it, he's totally right. I do say Huawei. I just say Huawei. That's wrong. It's Huawei.
Right. Huawei.
So there you go. The more you know. Neil from Halifax writes about our Google tracking story yesterday. He says, a little over a year ago, I was in a superstore and purchased a box of Vector cereal. Had never purchased that product before and wanted just to try it out. I paid with my Visa credit card. About 12 hours later, I was browsing Amazon and at the top of the list of suggested items was, you guessed it, Vector cereal. A few weeks later, I was in a Canadian Tire store and purchased a cleaner for hardware floors. Again, I paid with my Visa card. A day later, I got an email from Amazon suggesting that I could purchase the same product from Amazon. I informed a Canadian Tire manager of the story and heard nothing more about it. I also used the same card to purchase from Amazon. Is this something Amazon does? Does it raise the same ethical concerns? Kind of sounds very similar. I mean, seriously. That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, companies have so much data on us.
I hear
that all the time, especially around like the Amazon Echo or the Google Home or devices. You know, there was this whole thing of like, oh, it must have been listening to me because I was talking about luggage and then I got a luggage ad.
Right.
And it's like you were talking about luggage, but you were probably also searching on travel websites and you were also, you know, looking at, booking a flight and all these other things. You had emails in that about your flight. Like, there's so much data that I think it seems like, oh, all our devices are listening to us. They're not necessarily really just sitting there like,
oh, are they not?
I don't think they. It's so direct, but I just think there's so much data and so much guessing about what, you know, you putting that data, so much artificial intelligence and machine learning put through that data to try to guess at what you need, that's more of what it is. It's
but
not
it's weird
just,
when they get it right on it from a brand level too. Like, you buy a certain brand of cereal that you've never bought before, and then it's like, well, here's that same cereal that I've never heard of Vector. Vector cereal.
He's from Halifax.
Okay, well, maybe it's a bigger brand name in Halifax. I don't know, but you know what I mean. Like, there's some strange crossover. This is a topic that has come up quite a few times on All About Android, where we're like, so wait a minute, are these phones actually like listening? Because time and time again, we get these examples that are sent in where it's just a little too coincidental. However, I completely agree with what you're saying. We put a lot of signals out there. In just the way we use computers, and we use the computers for so many things, it might not be an explicit, I sit down and do a search for Vector cereal. You're right. We send signals in a lot of different ways, and maybe the more of those signals we send out there, the more narrowed down to a match that it thinks is going to work for us, we get, and there we go. Burke says, Amazon could be buying the information from credit card companies. Probably it's very true. Mm-hmm. And that's, well, yeah, could they be buying that information? Or have some sort of a deal that there would, I mean, and that would match what Google is doing. Google isn't necessarily buying the information in that, here, give us all of the credit card statements so that we can take a look at them. But like they said, it was a double blind match. So that's like when it matched on both sides, then they know that this is a match. Could be what Amazon's doing. I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, they also have the cards, like, you know, at the grocery store, do you use the card that gets you a discount? You know, that's, mm-hmm. I mean, they're not just giving that out of your loyalty for shopping there. That's so that they get the data of what you bought, what else you bought, what brands you bought, you know, what time you bought them. All of that is, you know, is being put into the data machine.
Yep. The mm-hmm. data machine. Mm-hmm. I like it. That's a title idea right there.
Brian sent us some feedback on our ongoing discussion regarding the internet connected salt shaker and our dystopian future, which is a great name for something. I don't know, a movie. But Brian wrote in earlier about what it would mean to have all of those devices connected, and he wanted to add that this sort of fear is not new. He pointed us to an old video from around the time the country was pushing a national ID system in the early 90s. Let's take a look and a listen at this video. Mm.
ACLU presents. In an incoming call.
Pizza Palace. Is this Mr. Kelly?
Yes.
Thank you for calling again, sir. I share your national identification number as 610-204-9998-45-54610. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. I see you live at 736 Montrose Court, but you're calling from your cell phone. Are you at home?
I'm just leaving work, but I'm...
Oh, we can deliver to Bob's Auto Supply.
No, I'm on my way home. How do you know all this stuff?
We just got wired into the system, sir.
Oh, well, I'd like to order a couple of your double meat special pizzas.
Sure thing. There'll be a new $20 charge for those, sir.
What do you mean?
Sir, the system shows me that your medical records indicate that you have high blood pressure and extremely high cholesterol. No. The total is $67 even.
$67?
Well, that includes too far removed from reality, to be completely honest.
Yeah.
Of traveling through an orange zone.
I live in an orange zone?
I live in an orange
zone? Looks like there was another robbery on Montrose yesterday.
But I want double meat.
Well, I'm sure you can afford the $67 then. You just bought those tickets to Hawaii. They weren't cheap, eh?
So you get the picture. Right. We'll put the link in the show notes. Cool, so you can watch this whole thing because it is exactly what we were talking about. Yeah. Like, you can afford that. You just bought those tickets to Hawaii. Or like Uber now is going to charge you more depending on where you go.
Right.
Like that sort of discriminated
pricing.
Where
you're pricing. Dropped off and everything like that.
Yeah. So it is not that far. We don't thankfully have to deal with those giant arrow cursors and the mouse and those windows, but everything else is still
everything there. Except for the user interface that you just saw is completely accurate.
Mm-hmm.
TNT's fan of the day is Noble Ackerson. Hey, Noble, it's nice to see you here on Twitter, who sent us these pictures of his Android Wear watch saying, this is not how I watch TNT. It's actually how I get through traffic sometimes. And he shows TNT playing the audio anyways being controlled on his Android Wear watch and a little traffic jam on the bottom screen. Noble, I haven't seen Noble. I bumped into Noble a number of times at different conferences and stuff, so he's a good guy. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. You can post it on Instagram, Google Plus, Twitter, or Facebook and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT and we'll find it.
Who needs smart pants when you can buy battery pants? Scientists at UMass Amherst say off-the-shelf power-generating clothes are almost here. The textile electronics researchers have discovered how to add breathable, pliable, metal-free electrodes to fabric so it's able to transport enough electricity to power small electronics. So as you move, the clothing creates the electricity and the fabric looks and feels good. The aim is to turn any garment made of fabric or any weave type into a conductor that harvests body motion energy and converts it into electricity. The scientists say the fabrics they tested can also withstand washing, rubbing, human sweat, and a lot of wear and tear.
Yeah. I mean, this sounds a lot like Project Jacquard from Google.
Well, Project Jacquard was more like you can touch it to play something, right? Like,
yeah, it's conductive.
Powering,
yeah, you're like, right. It's a different but the same. It's still the idea of embedding electronic circuitry into fabric, but mm-hmm. having that fabric still be very fabric-y and be able to stand up to, you know, being thrown into the washing machine and stuff like that. But yeah, in the side of Project Jacquard, it's really about like touch surfaces and everything like that. This is another aspect to this. Combine it. And wow, we're going to have some smart pants pretty soon.
Right. But you could have smart pants or a smart jacket that just lit up at night if you were riding a bike or walking by yourself. Like things that I think make more sense than just being able to touch your arm to respond to an email.
Or let's say we get to a point to where when you go to the gym and you're wearing the right clothes and you've got your phone in the pocket of the clothes that generate power when you run so you can charge your phone while you're at the gym.
Mm-hmm. I would like that.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
See, there's options here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not too unbelievable to think that it might actually happen. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC at twit.tv/live. Be part of the show by emailing us, tnt@twit.tv. You can leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. And you can find us on Twitter. We're at Tech News Today TV.
And share your thoughts on our subreddit. It is technewstoday.reddit.com. If you like the kind of stories that we're talking about, then upvote the stories that you like. If you don't like what we're talking about, get there. Put something that you do like. We check it, and maybe we'll see that. And you can also find all the ways to subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director, Brian Burnett. Thanks to Burke for helping out here in the studio. Thanks to Kevin for editing the show. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everybody.